morning, Chair Horn, members of the board. My name is Dan Sussman. I'm an environmental scientist here in the South Lake Tahoe office in the Basin Planning and PMBL unit. And today I'm going to present to you the draft Lake Tahoe Nearshore Water Quality Control Protection Plan, excuse me. And I will be seeking your direction on this plan. This is a pretty straightforward presentation, outline-wise. I'm going to briefly remind you of some of the key findings from the Nearshore report that was presented to you in November. Then I'm going to introduce the draft Nearshore Protection Plan before I'll close by summarizing public response that we've received and asking for your direction. So you might recall this slide as part of the presentation that you saw in November. The key findings of the Nearshore Scientific Report are that the Nearshore is a heterogeneous environment. It's not the same all the way around the lake, and this adds to Tahoe's beauty, but it also creates some challenges for us. Between Lahontan, the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and TRPA, there are many existing standards and indicators for Lake Tahoe which apply to the Nearshore, and these standards help to guide our management of Lake Tahoe for water quality purposes. There's no current integrated nearshore water quality monitoring plan, and this is a need that we want to address. And current efforts at Lake Tahoe should have a positive impact on improving the Lake Tahoe nearshore. So the draft nearshore plan accomplishes a number of goals. It demonstrates your commitment to the Lake Tahoe nearshore, and staff recognizes the need to address the nearshore. This plan provides us the roadmap or approach towards nearshore protection as informed by that Nearshore Scientific Report. The plan identifies opportunities for collaboration with partner agencies and the public, as well as identifying challenges, both technical and importantly funding challenges that we may face in seeking to implement this protection plan. Finally, it acts as a response to the Budget Act of 2012, which asked for a section approach to address the nearshore, including a timeline. So these are the elements of the plan, and I'll let you read through them, but I'm going to go through each of them in the subsequent slides. This slide here is to present all the elements in one place, and I want you to take a look at it, please, because I'll be asking for your feedback and direction as a board on the plan. So during this presentation, please think about anything that should be changed, added, removed, any comments that you might have. The first element is the Nearshore Monitoring Plan, and a plan that would address multiple aspects of water quality. Having such a plan will allow us to characterize nearshore conditions, track changes in key environmental indicators, and identify parts of the nearshore that might take a little bit more attention, that might be experiencing more chronic problems that are in need of further investigation. This is a figure from the Nearshore report, and it again shows the monitoring metrics on the left-hand column, turbidity, light transmissivity, chlorophyll, on down the line. Remember that the scientific report divided the different monitoring metrics into four different indicators or indicator categories. And the relation of these metrics to indicators is shown in the second column: clarity, trophic status, community structure, and human health. Also, please take a look at that third column, the databases. Though the data that we do have is high quality, the quantity of it really varies, and you can see that there's a lot of lines of poor in there, indicating that, once again, the need for an integrated nearshore monitoring plan. Currently, the Lahontan Board, through an agreement with UC Davis, monitors periphyton and phytoplankton, so algae attached to rocks and then algae that is free-floating. We've been supporting periphyton monitoring here in the basin for the past decade or so. And this summer, the nearshore agencies hope to implement a pilot program to monitor clarity metrics as well as some biological metrics, with the hope of creating an annual monitoring program. Toxicity and harmful bacteria is something that we monitor episodically on a case-by-case basis when there's a spill, but there are opportunities to access more frequent water quality data from the water suppliers, some of whom pull directly from the lake, and though their intake pipes might be out 1,000 feet, in some cases that still fits into the definition of the nearshore because they remain relatively shallow. We plan on expanding our current monitoring efforts this year and refining and building out the monitoring effort in subsequent years. So one of the good things about the nearshore is that we aren't exactly starting from scratch. In addition to fine sediment, the Tahoe TMDL, which was adopted a couple of years ago by this board, also focuses on nutrients, nitrogen, and phosphorus, which are the primary controls of nearshore changes as it relates to algae growth and feeding some of the aquatic invasive plants that we have. The report describes that with most pollutants entering the mid-lake, by passing through the nearshore, the Lake Tahoe TMDL most of the pollutants enter through the nearshore, and so the TMDL's implementation will have a beneficial effect on reducing these. The other big issue in the nearshore is aquatic invasive species, and there's a pretty robust Lake Tahoe aquatic invasive species program, which works to prevent new introductions with boat inspection and Tahoe keepers and other prevention programs, detect new infestations, and implement control projects. And this has found some good success, particularly as an example in Emerald Bay, where they've reduced the invasive plants to really just a maintenance level from what could be described as more of a forest in some areas. I've already mentioned monitoring, so I won't dwell on it, but I want to remind everyone of our existing standards again, because these provide the framing for management of the nearshore. And there's a few examples of some of our standards up there. Now, we've heard some concern that sewage leaks from old pipes can have a significant impact on the nearshore, and this might be so, especially from smaller collection systems. But on the California side of the lake, the Lahontan Water Board has permits with the public utility districts, South Tahoe, Tahoe City, and North Tahoe. And these permits require sewer management plans, and the plans must include the agency's schedule, the PD schedule, for periodically checking their lines for leaks. Now, we have received some questions about tracking implementation of these schedules. And then also, I want to recall that Board Member Sandell at the November meeting raised the question, or the conversation, about permitting other sewer collection systems, some of the smaller systems that are not directly owned by the PUDs. Again, Lahontan's not the only party concerned with the nearshore. TRPA and other groups have additional programs and policies that help protect the nearshore, and a few of them are listed here, from vehicle emission standards, which can help reduce dust entrainment and nitrogen, TURC buyback program, and fertilizer management plans are a few examples. So the nearshore is not the same everywhere, and these differences around the lake and in the adjacent uplands as well influence what we see in the nearshore. We know that there are hot spots around the lake, problem areas of elevated environmental change, whether it be increased periphyton growth, remember that's the attached algae, the slippery rocks, turbidity, or a propensity for hosting different aquatic invasive species. Now, this map is just an example. It combines 5 years of periphyton monitoring data by UC Davis from 2008 to 2012. You can see elevated periphyton growth up near Sunnyside, which is right there, that dark red color, and then to a lesser extent in these brown areas and then the orange areas as well. If we're looking at each of these, each of the 5 years represented here individually, we might not see these colors indicating chronic areas of environmental change. Unfortunately, at this time, we don't have such consistent data for other monitoring metrics. And so while there might be other issues in the nearshore, you really don't know chronically unless you have a good data set to overlay. And that's yet another reason for our proposed monitoring plan, so that you can gather that sort of empirical evidence. Now, we propose to investigate these areas, conducting a causal assessment with the goal of determining if there are actual opportunities to address these areas through management actions in the future. Pending funding restraints, we hope to begin this first assessment as early as 2015. And just as a visual of what an area like that might look like, this is an example of some heavy growth of periphyton. So considering nearshore-specific standards, the next element of our plan is assessing our need for new water quality standards. Existing standards are important to nearshore water quality management, and they're designed to protect the beneficial uses of the water, be it municipal supply, drinking water, which is drinking water, non-contact recreation, contact recreation, actually wading in their cold freshwater habitat, or some of our other beneficial uses. So the question is, are these standards protective enough? Is there a better approach? Or do we have enough information with these standards to be able to take any actions that we need to? Now, the report recommends 10 metrics for monitoring of nearshore environment. I showed that in one of the earlier slides. So if we were to evaluate whether we wanted to create new standards, it makes sense that we would look to start with these monitoring metrics as a starting place. That starting place provides a list that we can evaluate to see if we should create standards for them. Now, standards development is a resource-intensive development process. First, there's that evaluation. Then, for example, the board would need to decide if we did want to move forward with a standard. What type of standard would it be? Narrative or numeric? If it's numeric, are we basing it on current conditions, literature values, some sort of historic condition? Or it's just a statistical analysis. Another option is to create a standard based on aesthetics. Public perception, such as how much periphyton just looks right to the public, is another option. This is a decision complicated, of course, by the heterogeneic nature of the nearshore, where in some areas you might have an issue, and in other areas it's just not the right the right lake environment to support those issues. Now, to develop a standard also requires that evaluation, right? So looking at this evaluation process, there are some questions that will help the board if you want to pursue new standards. There needs to be assurances that the new standard provides added value over existing standards or over an existing combination of standards. What do those things tell us? And does creating a new standard actually create new value? Does the chosen metric duplicate other standards? The metric should be able to reflect environmental change, but not be subject to too much variability, too much noise. And if the point of the nearshore standard is to inform management actions, then any new standard should be responsive to control measures. And these criteria were supported by some of the oral and written comments that we did receive from the public. Then there's the question of, is there sufficient data at this time? And so in the case of some of these metrics, that might not be the case. So to summarize, the Water Board staff will undergo a process of evaluation of these different metrics. If the chosen path is to develop a new standard, we'll need to make sure that there's enough data. And if we want to have a representative data set on which to set a standard, then we need to sample more intensively. We may need to sample more intensively than just normal trends monitoring, or over a longer period of time, or both. And what I didn't mention up here, in terms of the level of resource intensity, is it's a process, including the public process, CEQA, taking it through the board, and up through EPA as well. So we want to make sure it's the right decision. And we're hoping to begin this evaluation process sometime later this year. So climate change is something that represents a real challenge with real effects on the near shore. This is a figure here that shows the increase of lake water temperature over time since the 70s. Increase in water temperature can affect algae growth and habitat for invasive species. So that's two impacts. And then, of course, it also has impacts on the precipitation regime, which can affect our management actions and what goes on in the lake as well. So there is funding at the state level for climate change adaptation, and we hope to access some of those funds for this effort starting optimistically in 2015 sometime. Now, the last element of our plan is public engagement. And I want to highlight our need for continued public engagement because we share an interest and a responsibility with the public on the nearshore. Together with the other nearshore agencies of the Nearshore Working Group, the TRPA, the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, and the US EPA, we hosted two public outreach meetings, one on January 30th, and then on the South Shore in this very room, and then a second one last Friday on February 7th in the North Shore. It was originally scheduled for the 30th, but due to the snowstorm that day, we postponed it. The format of the meetings was a recap of the Nearshore Evaluation Report, followed by a similar presentation to what I just delivered, and a brief note on the steps individuals can take towards protecting the Nearshore. Together, those meetings were very well attended. The first one had over 40 individuals, and the second one, well, it was snowing that day too, and we had 7 people show up on the North Shore. So close to 50 people, though, between the two. The attendees represented a wide range of interests from agencies such as state parks and the Resource Conservation District, the private side with environmental consultants and marina operators, members of the environmental community, water purveyors, and members of the press. And out of that, there was an article in the LakeTahoeNews.net website as well as the Tahoe Daily Tribune. So I have 2 slides on public feedback. One, what we gathered day of, and then we did receive a few written comments as well. So several attendees shared their observations just from visiting the Nearshore, the sort of anecdotal evidence that has prompted or helped to prompt this concern. Others asked for clarification about the hotspots, and that really provided me with an opportunity to clarify that Periphyton was really just an example. That map is not the be-all, end-all, and that there may be other areas in the lake that see other changes, but for the most part, we don't have the data to say anything more definitively than maybe over here we should be looking at turbidity or something else. There was a suggestion that we not only monitor the near shore, not only monitor the metrics that indicate environmental change, but also the nutrients coming into the near shore. And that led to a conversation about the importance of integrating the proposed nearshore monitoring program with other programs, such as the Aquatic Invasive Species Program, stormwater monitoring under the TMDL, and as well as sharing information between the nearshore agencies and the water suppliers, who I mentioned regularly sample their intakes for public health impacts. And on that topic of microorganisms, we did have an oral comment as well from the Lake Tahoe Lakefront Owners Association, who brought up goose excrement as a source of harmful microorganisms, but also as nutrients. So generally, we've received support for our approach of monitoring the 10 metrics and for the plan in general. And we know that specifically because monitoring for all the 60-some standards between the 3 agencies would really be a lot, and it might be best to focus just on these 10 things. And there was recognition of our funding constraints as well. There was a question about the monitoring and investigations proposed in the draft plan versus talking about potential changes to management actions as well. And we're really not sure what those management actions be necessarily at this point, because we're still gathering data to see how effective things are. Finally, we did an informal poll of attendees and their view of what indicators are important to monitor. Remember, that was the clarity, the trophic status, the community structure, and the human health. And it was a rough informal poll that we did at both of the events to see, well, where should we prioritize monitoring if we have limited amounts of funding. And trophic status came out as the big winner, followed by clarity and community structure, and then human health, because we have such clean water, fell forth. So we received 4 written comments from the League to Save Lake Tahoe, the Tahoe Resource Conservation District, an email from California State Parks and the US EPA, and those were included in a late edition that I believe you received yesterday. And I think for the audience, there's some copies in the back as well. Overall, it was a message of support, but there was recognition of funding limitations needed for funding to maintain control projects as well, you know, operations and maintenance of control projects as well as just the monitoring and investigations that are outlined in this plan. Questions about how we will prioritize monitoring and management actions, enforcement of existing regulations, emphasizing that they should be enforced, and monitoring of our standards. Encouraging adaptive management, both in response to change we see in the near shore and as it relates to the TMDL implementation measures and responding to hotspots and in response to climate change events. There was the suggestion that we outline in the plan how we may change management and regulatory strategies as a result of monitoring and hotspot finding. And then the suggestion to consider new standards and an emphasis on stakeholder engagement as this process is not expected to be just a one-year fix. So to reiterate, these are the plan elements and their initiation date, and it's a fairly aggressive approach, and one partly dependent on funding as well. One schedule factor that is not on this slide is what happens next after you give me your feedback. And staff will take that feedback as well as the feedback from the public and incorporate that direction into the draft plan to create a more vital plan. And then we plan to fulfill the request of the legislature and bring this document down to them sometime next month, as early as next month. So now you've seen the plan and heard a selection of the key comments of the public, and I'd like to solicit your direction in general, but bounded by or specifically answers to these questions. I mean, just generally, is this a balanced approach? Do you see that there were missing elements, or maybe something that we don't need in this document? Do you have an opinion on prioritization that we can place on these different approach elements or specific to monitoring? What should be prioritized or how should we prioritize? And then the time schedule, is it reasonable? So I can leave that up there if you'd like.
I just want to remind folks in the audience, if you would like to make comments on this item, please give us one of these orange cards so I know to call on you. Thank you very much. Thank you for that good presentation. Board, do you have any questions for him, Mr. Sandell?
I don't have a specific question, but I have a kind of a very general comment about all of this. It's all very useful, but throughout all of the presentation, two questions that I've had are, what besides temperature has changed to change the nearshore from what it was 20 years ago? And two, what possibly can we do to reverse whatever it is that's happening? And I was thinking that I would like to see as part of this presentation our staff and perhaps with the help of others' best scientifically based speculation theory about what the causes are and what the possible solutions might be. We're totally lacking that as far as I've been able to see so far. And I think that it would give me something to a framework into which to put the results of all of our current ongoing kind of research.
Do you have anything you want to respond?
In terms of causes, the report really emphasized nitrogen and phosphorus because it really was looking at the biological elements. And then the other thing that it really emphasized is an issue is aquatic invasive species and their introductions. So in terms of response to those things, for the impacts of of nutrients and to a lesser extent fine sediment in the near shore. A lot of the response is what is currently under the Lake Tahoe TMDL, and that is a program that's relatively young. And so one of the reasons why we need to do monitoring is not just to monitor the status of the lake, but to see if there are spots that are changing a little bit more, and also looking upslope as well, to see if there's more or different strategies that we could do. But the report was really focused on that overlap there. In terms of aquatic invasive species, we have the aquatic invasive species program here in Lake Tahoe. We're trying to prevent things from getting worse with the prevention efforts. And in terms of control efforts, what we're really dealing with here is, for aquatic invasive species, is the Asian clams, which have proven a real challenge, and then the aquatic invasive plants, which, though challenging on small scale, control projects have been relatively successful, and the program is currently undergoing an environmental document for a lake-wide implementation plan so that there isn't a real so that there is a unified approach towards that program, as opposed to just looking at this space or that spot or this infestation. And so that is a partial answer to your question.
I noticed in one of the responses, I think it was the last one, that there was speculation about dust coming in, and that our efforts to reduce the density of the forest around the lake is also allowing the dust to get through that would have been trapped by the forest.
Yeah, that is something that that's one of those questions that I wish I had a little bit earlier in terms of having it addressed by the scientific report. Most of the folks that worked on the science report are limnologists or aquatic biologists, and to have that perspective come in, I think would have been beneficial. And it's not a new concept to have forests act as filters for aerial dust. And as you can guess, there's probably a few players that have different opinions on the relative importance of that. So I'm not really sure where we go from there.
What could you possibly do to deal with the paraphyton? That seems to be the most obvious manifestation of a possible problem.
Right. Although
I'm not sure what could you do to reduce to change the environment so that they don't thrive.
Well, I guess it would be reduction of inputs, right? So, there's a couple complications there, right? If there's warming of the water, then that helps promote the algae growth, and that's something that we don't really have that much control over, unfortunately, at the Lahontan Board level. In terms of other inputs, though, the nutrients that feed them, the hope is that our existing control measures and forthcoming control measures will help to reduce those inputs. I mentioned the hotspots, the causal assessments, which indicates that in some areas of the lake it's worse than others. And that in part might be, in the South Shore we don't really have an issue with periphyton so much, but we also don't have a lot of hard substrate for periphyton to grow on. And so how do you tease it out? And in other places, even if there is hard substrate, there might be less or more growth of the periphyton. And so the idea with doing a causal assessment, a hotspot investigation, would be to look at those areas that are chronically showing elevated growth of periphyton. And that map really addresses the measurement in terms of aerial extent. The metric they're using is aerial extent of periphyton and the length of the actual filaments growing. And so it would be to look at those areas and say, is there something that we're not seeing here? Is that we can actually control? Not just is it warming up, but are there areas that we're missing? Are there roads and other conduits that that have yet to have their erosion control or their other methods applied there. Should we look at some of those, some groundwater, maybe to look at if there is sewer leakage with, especially with those unregulated collection systems? And so to do that sort of investigation focused on things that we might actually be able to influence as a management agency and regulatory agency.
Thank you.
Ms. Cox? How is the interjurisdictional cooperation between the California side and the Nevada side on this project?
In terms of at my level of trying to figure out our approach and trying to figure out what are we going to focus our monitoring on, it's really good. We have the nearshore agency work group, those TRPA, Nevada, US EPA, and ourselves shepherded or managed the scientific report for the 2+ years or so that it was underway as an investigation. And we've been meeting ever since as well. And so from that perspective, it's good. I guess I would defer to another member of our staff. I'm not very familiar with in terms of how that works on in terms of putting erosion control and other management measures on the ground.
Mr. Jordan?
Just quite observation. I believe this is a balanced approach, but I believe also there needs to be an integrated plan, as you suggested at the beginning, to the entire Lake Tahoe Basin, both the Nevada and California side. And I think there definitely needs to be more monitoring of where we're going. And we're all in this together. So it's that's it.
Thank you.
A couple questions. Can we go to slide number 7? I was just curious, what do we gain by monitoring both turbidity and light transmissivity? Or
yeah, it's a good question. So turbidity is really good for figuring out murky waters, but when you get to that, those are waters that are still relatively clear, or when you have a big column of water where you can throw a secchi disc down and it'll actually disappear after a point. When we have these more clean waters, then it's not as sensitive of a measurement. You can't put a secchi disc in there because it'll hit the bottom and still look like the plate that it is. But transmissivity looks at the light attenuation, so it doesn't matter if it's deep or murky, and it's more sensitive, more appropriate at those cleaner, more clear levels of water. And so the idea with turbidity and light transmissivity is that you could take them at the same time, and there's a proposal to those first three are actually turbidity, light transmissivity, and chlorophyll are, we refer to those as the clarity metrics, so there's overlap with tropic for chlorophyll. And one proposal which has been put forward is to have boats do trips around the lake, around the near shore at different depth contours with a continuous sampling. And so you would get the turbidity and the light transmissivity and be able to hopefully come up with some sort of correlation, some sort of relationship between them. Because our standard is mostly for turbidity here at the lake, but since transmissivity is a little bit better at those clear levels, then being able to use that relationship and just standard purposes focus on transmissivity. So
to phase out, to maybe change the standard to transmissivity and phase out monitoring for turbidity?
Whether we change the standard or not, I'll leave that question up to you guys and up to further evaluation. but it provides a, I don't want to say clearer picture, because that's such a horrible pun, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was just a little bit concerned about redundancy and effort, and so we would streamline the monitoring anyway. So that sounds good.
Yeah, the streamlining and monitoring is something, I mean, I've mentioned our funding constraints, and that's something that we're looking at in terms of, I have a backup slide if you want to see, which was the recommended, the scientists recommended monitoring framework, which included, you know, their frequency and other things like that. And so those are the things that we, frequency of monitoring, other things like that. So those are the type of things that we can look at in terms of, you know, reducing frequency, or after we get a baseline couple of years, reducing it, or maybe the number of locations that are sampled. I mean, these are all things that we're struggling with as we try to develop this, have our preliminary conversations of developing this and trying to figure out what our funding picture looks like.
Okay. And then I have a question, and maybe Mr. Larson wants to offer some comments at this point. I'm just curious, I think it would be helpful to set the context of where this nearshore piece fits in with the overall TMDL. I mean, so a question I have is the nearshore effort solely managed, solely directed towards investigating whether new standards are appropriate, or might there be management actions that are particular to the nearshore that aren't currently part of the TMDL program?
Bob Larson, I'm a senior environmental scientist here with the Water Board, working primarily on the Lake Tahoe TMDL program, so thanks for your question. Yes, there's a ton of overlap between the nearshore questions, obviously, and the nearshore program that we're putting forward. As Dan indicated, all of the water that's flowing into the deep water, most of it is passing through the nearshore area, so any actions that we're taking to reduce the nutrient loading to the lake is ultimately influencing the nearshore water quality. So right now what we're looking at, just as Dan outlined, is really trying to better understand the dynamics of the nearshore, getting at Eric's question of what are the drivers for the nearshore change. Initial indicators suggest that the drivers aren't that different, in that the nutrients that are influencing the deep water are also influencing the algae that we see growing on the rocks and the increased productivity that we see in the nearshore. So what the nearshore report lays out, and what we, indications suggest, is that the actions that we're taking, particularly in the urban stormwater program, but also in stream restoration and other restoration work in the basin, to reduce the amount of pollutants that are ultimately reaching the lake, will have a positive influence on the nearshore environment. So getting at your question, sort of where does the overlap fit, I guess what we need initially, and again, Dan, I think, has done a really good job of highlighting this, is we need more data to better understand what's happening at the nearshore, so we can more positively say, yes, this is, you know, the TMDL actions that we're taking, particularly to reduce fine sediment and the associated phosphorus, are having the desired impact that we want on the nearshore. Some of the actions we're taking in the transportation program to reduce nitrogen loading, et cetera, that those are appropriate. And if they are or are not, then we can start to ask the question of what additional management measures might be necessary to address the nearshore. I think that, you know, the question of the sewage infrastructure is a great one, right? I think that is really one area where that may be having a disproportionate impact on the nearshore, as opposed to the deep water lake that is, you know, been driven by the fine sediment particles. So that's one instance where there might be a different approach towards management and some additional implementation actions that may be necessary to address where we have an opportunity to really target some work to influence the nearshore. So, yeah, right now it's trying to figure out where the monitoring overlap is. We've been funding UC Davis for a number of decades now to do Lake Tahoe water quality investigations as a whole. We've directed those funds over the next few years to more do some more targeted work in the nearshore. We're hoping to get some additional resources to elevate that so we can start to answer those questions. The Regional Stormwater Monitoring Program, looking at the concentrations of nutrients in urban stormwater. Again, there's a lot of overlap in what we want to monitor for the nearshore and what we want to monitor for the deep lake. So, does that get any questions?
Yeah, okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Bob.
Let me see if I have any other questions. So the plan that's coming forward for a lake-wide approach to control aquatic invasive plants, might there be any impact as well on both attached and detached algae from that program?
It's really just looking at, I'd say probably not, it's really just looking at measures to identify and treat examples of Eurasian water milfoil and parallel pondweed through either the hand-guided suction pulling with the diver down there, you know, pull it out of the ground, stick it in there, not to sweep everything, as well as using using mats to put out the light as well. And that's been used it's been used at several areas along the South Shore and in Emerald Bay. The aquatic invasive plants is another example of just how different it is in different parts of the near shore around the lake. On the North Shore, outside of marinas, there's really just the known infestation outside on the lakeside and the riverside of the dam. In the South Shore, it's, we have other areas as well.
Okay. Let me see if I have any other questions.
And they're currently in the phase of they funded an environmental document to be able to tear off all the permits and everything.
Okay. So with that, we have two comment cards. Melissa, I can't read your writing. Okay. From the League to Save Lake Tahoe.
My name is Melissa Thaw, and I'm representing the League to Save Lake Tahoe. And we appreciate the opportunity to comment on this plan. The League supports science-based management, so we think that the Lake Tahoe Nearshore Evaluation and Monitoring Framework is an excellent resource to develop your plan from. And I want to start out with a question. The plan quotes the Budget Act of 2012 stating that the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board shall, within 120 days of receipt of a scientific report on Lake Tahoe Nearshore indicators, establish a schedule for the development and adoption of the Lake Tahoe Nearshore Water Quality Objectives to improve Lake Tahoe Nearshore Water Quality Conditions, along with a comprehensive implementation strategy. And so I was wondering, the plan here is called a Water Quality Protection Plan, but it sounds like most of it is outlining monitoring. This plan should include additional protection strategies and management strategies that will result in tangible nearshore improvement. Also, we agree with, it looks like the TRCD sent in comments talking about the, from Kim Gorman, she mentions that she thinks that the program should be strategically developed within the context of other monitoring programs. And we agree that this program should be strategically implemented along with the TMDL Lake Tahoe Interagency Monitoring Program and the R-Swamp, because the nearshore is connected with the watershed. I also would like to know, can this nearshore monitoring program facilitate adaptive management with the TMDL? Will this monitoring program be able to link pollution sources with nearshore problems? And then what tangible solutions will be developed from that? And we have submitted a written comment letter, and I hope that you get the chance to read that. And there's one more thing that it looks like the TRCD also submitted comments about the prioritization criteria, and we would also like to know what's being used for prioritization since funding is limited.
Prioritization for
monitoring?
For monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sussman, do you want to respond to the adaptive management comment question?
Sure. I will start, and if Bob has something else to add, I would welcome him up here. One of the things that Melissa brought was, can this monitoring really look at the causality between what's being implemented on the land and what's happening in the lake? And I guess that's where I'd focus on the hotspots, and the just general monitoring around the lake will help us identify what those areas are that have that heightened elevated change, and then we would see funding to, if it's not easily identifiable, then look at those areas with a more investigative eye to see if there are management actions that we're missing or things that can be tweaked. And I guess that would be the approach there. We don't always get everything right on the first time, and so that's why we need monitoring, and that's why the TMDL has permitting system under 5-year return interval.
I guess I'll just add to that the Lake Tahoe, we're in the process right now of developing a Lake Tahoe TMDL management system. I've spoken to this board a couple times about that. And we're getting quite close, actually, to delivering some of the first products of that process. But this is exactly the type of information that the TMDL management system is anticipating that we'll be gathering in the future, analyzing the potential implications associated with any monitoring data, and then making informed decisions about whether or not we need to have, whether or not we have opportunities to adjust the implementation approach to better achieve not only our TMDL goals, but a broad suite of our water quality objectives here in the Tahoe Basin, including the nearshore. So we are developing and implementing a comprehensive adaptive management program that will explicitly do, I think, what Ms. Thaw is asking in terms of adaptively managing based on scientific information.
Thank you. I have another comment card from Jennifer Quashman.
All right, good morning, Jennifer Kwasnik, and I'm here for Friends of the West Shore and the Tahoe Area Sierra Club. And I want to thank staff for this presentation and for the work that's gone into this. And I want to apologize, we did submit some comments, but I guess it was a little bit too late last night. But we did keep them short, 2 pages. So I just want to mention a few highlights from that. First, we agree with the discussion about monitoring based on science-based management and managing based on monitoring. We support that. We are a bit concerned that the current plan doesn't sufficiently address the relationship between what's going on the land versus what's going on in the nearshore. And we also, on that note, have concerns with the nutrients and with the current regional planning efforts. There's a lot of emphasis on reducing phosphorus, which is great, but not a lot of emphasis on nitrogen. And I'm going to mirror Laurel Ames here, and I will pass around our photo here, nitrogen plus phosphorus equals that stuff. We also hope that the study will focus more on the impacts of boating, both to the how the boat props stir up fish spawning substrate and the fish feed and cover substrate, as well as stirring up fine sediments and redistributing them in the lake. And we had at the previous public workshop submitted a newer publication that looks at some of this information, and so we put that again on this letter. With regards to the plan, it was unclear if a community structure indicator was going to be adopted. And so that was one of our questions. And then finally, just wrap it up again with reiterating, as the plan notes, impervious surface near the lake has a huge impact on what's going on in the nearshore. And so we just really need to be careful that we are monitoring enough to know what land activities are affecting the nearshore. So thank you.
Thank you. With that, board have any feedback to provide staff on this program, or do you want to respond to that? Go into direction?
We've received that the recent study or paper that she mentioned, and are reviewing it. we are not in disagreement about integrating those monitoring plan that looks at the lake and status versus with the other monitoring efforts that are going on in Lake Tahoe. And I don't have much more to add right now, but I welcome anyone else or welcome board direction.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Jardine, Ms. Scott, Mr. Sandel?
I think it's been brought up a couple of times, not by me today, but the possible monitoring of private sewage collection systems, and I wonder whether you have plans to, I'm not sure exactly what the best approach would be, but to approach it somehow as part of what we're doing.
We brought that up in the context of looking at hotspots, right? Looking at areas of parasitic hotspots in particular. And if we got that funding, then that we haven't designed that study, haven't designed the, what the project description would be, but it seems like that would be a good thing to include. Because there is concern that that is a provider of nutrients. How we would do that is a little, we're not quite there yet, whether we would seek cooperation with sewers, sewer collections, which are often just homeowners associations that then have that collection system connected to one of the PUDs, or whether we would start with some groundwater wells just to see if there is elevated nutrient flow through the groundwater. We're not quite there yet. True.
Do you have a list and location of private collection systems yet?
No, and that would be something that we would need to seek out.
Seems like that would be readily available through all of our permitted agencies.
Dr. Harmon and members of the board, I know that Dan's been focused, obviously, on the monitoring elements, and I know that Ron Tucker in our office, who handles all of our wastewater treatment and collection permits, has also kind of explored this idea. And I think this is an opportunity for the board to say, hey, I think this is something we ought to pursue, because one of the things that came to our attention when Rob Tucker was being contacted by some of our local sewer agencies is that the State Board Sanitary Sewer Overflow Collection System, they have a general permit for collection systems, that the threshold for enrolling under that permit is for much larger systems. And so these small systems have kind of fallen through the cracks in terms of having requirements that require regular inspection and maintenance. And I think that we probably have enough evidence to support us going after these smaller systems within, close proximity to the lake. I mean, that we could just require them to provide us the same kind of information that larger systems collect right now, and that they're required to do. So that's something that I think could be on an independent track from actually, I think if Mike Plazak and others would tell you that our typical scenario would be we'd go out and try to seek evidence to show that there's an actual problem before we would require additional corrective action or investigation. But I think in this particular situation at Lake Tahoe, where we have a lot of data and there's a threat from these collection systems and all the other systems that are larger are under a program with regular inspection and maintenance, I think we could use that to support a information request like the 13267 order or require that they enroll under the statewide general permit. That's something we could explore. Similar to how we've treated stormwater in the Tahoe Basin, that we started dealing with it long before US EPA, before the basin crossed the threshold for a national standard to actually have stormwater regulation. We could pursue that. So that's just something that might could happen separately from Dan's effort on monitoring and looking at hot spots.
Anything else? I agree with Mr. Sandel, and I like the idea of approaching these smaller systems on an independent track. I don't see there's any real reason to wait on that. In the report, I really like the concept of taking the area between Tahoe City and Blackwood as kind of a starting place to really focus on. I think it provides an opportunity for both looking at the question of the smaller sewer systems and
the effects of voting that Ms. Kwasnik brought up. And since funding is limited, that might, you know, focusing on one place and looking at the integrated effects in one place makes a lot of sense. And from that one hot spot, maybe we'll get some good progress in that. I think when I was reading the material that you gave us, I wanted to see a goal statement. And I mean, so something that's not a standard. I'm not talking about anything that's, but just kind of a narrative of where we're trying to go with. I didn't see one.
You'll see one.
I mean, roughly, broadly, we're trying to get there.
Good start.
Okay.
We can highlight that.
This is Doug Smith, supervising geologist at the Water Board. This desired condition statement was actually developed several years ago as part of the pathway process where all the agencies got together and all the scientists.
I'm going to have to step in and say it was guided by those, but this particular one was one of the products of the Nearshore report, and it was several years ago. It was one of the first things that the scientists and staff and executive officers at that time, we had a different one, but came up with or vetted through the executive officers, informed very much by the similar process with Pathway 7, 2007, that came up with these sort of statements for the lake in general.
The pathway statement is essentially the same.
Well, except for it's the whole
okay.
lake. It's for the whole
lake. It really is.
Okay.
So I'm less familiar with the pathway. Than
this is great to see. Thank you. I have a pet peeve with the word condition, just because it puts the idea of a static situation in people's minds.
Gotcha.
So let's talk about our desired future or something. So I don't like the word condition. And
because, as we discussed, we're not in a static situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we have the word conditions in the actual statement. Down below, the third line just at least talks about reflecting conditions consistent, which is a little better than just...
It's a little better. I don't like the word condition, so get rid of that. So I think this is a good statement for internal... the working groups and the scientists who are working on all this together, monitoring groups and everything. I think we need a more public-friendly version of this that's a little less technical. Mm-hmm. So that is just like, at the top of every time we talk about the nearshore environment. So, the 70-year-old guy who's been visiting here since he was 10 years old gets what we're doing with the nearshore environment. And the 10-year-old girl does too. Mm-hmm. So if we could see that in the next time you come before the board, a new version of this, that would be good. Okay, and then driving forwards way down the line, if we ever get to setting new standards on this, so one of the things you mentioned was historic condition, and because everything is so dynamic, I mean, historic conditions can give us information about what was, but it should not be driving what the standards are. The standards, to me, are very clearly driven about, the constraints of what's possible and what we want, whoever we is. We collectively want. It's not driven by what was in the past. That's direction.
Good job.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.